It's the 26th of November and it's Coffee, Cake and Dharma morning. And today's topic is dealing with difficult emotions. So that we made a list of themes for these mornings months ago, and the theme that we decided for this morning was dealing with difficult emotions, which, as I said to Fiona early in the week, I sort of suggested because I thought it might be one that she might do. But I'm doing it. I had some thoughts in the week, so I was sort of thinking, okay, so difficult emotions. And I thought, well, what is it? Why do we... what is it about difficult emotions that are difficult? Why, and sort of what can we do about them, and those sorts of questions. So from a Buddhist point of view, which is the point of view I'll be talking from, what's difficult about difficult emotions is that they present a challenge to our identity or self-image. I think that's the nub of it.
Mm-hmm.
So often because of some real event that's happened, and I think there's... so that's one thing to say. And the other thing I want to say is also from my point of view, or maybe from a Buddhist point of view as well, is actually difficult emotions or difficult situations only become a problem, if you like, when we start to create a new identity based around those emotions or that situation that's affecting us. Actually, there's entirely appropriate, powerful emotions to have. If somebody that you love dies, it's entirely appropriate for a grieving process. You know, in Victorian England, you'd have a year where you would wear black, and that was considered the length of time that you would be in mourning for, and after that then you got ready and you got on with your new life. And actually, that's quite helpful. To know that you've got a year to grieve is quite helpful to do, and you do it in a public way. And also to know that after that, you get on with your new life. That's also very helpful to the process, I think. And actually, if we take that example from a Buddhist point of view, it almost skillfully makes use of the identity forming process that I mentioned at the beginning. So probably I'll say a little bit about what I mean by the identity forming process, and I'll look at that example again. So the basic view of Buddhist psychology is that the things in the world that we encounter give rise to particular emotions in us. So you encounter something and you have an emotional response to it, and then you do something with that emotion. You maybe push things away from you, you isolate yourself, so you draw things towards you, you go and eat lots of food or drink lots, and you can... that those things can become habitual. That's one way of creating a story, is you become somebody who really enjoys a glass of wine at the end of the day, or somebody who likes not to be in social situations. You can sort of create an identity out of the actions that you originally did in response to some trauma. But I think you can also create an identity out of the story that you tell about a particular trauma. So, and almost it becomes the only story that you have about your identity. So, hello, my name is so-and-so. This bad thing happened to me 10 years ago, and I'm still bringing it up every time I meet new people. You know, and I've met people like that. And their whole... all of their activities that they do are anchored on this one event, which can be okay, you know. If those are... hello, kittens. You know, you see people like that who go on to set up charities after their children have died, and actually that those kind of things can motivate good work. So there's also a question about whether it's a functional identity or a dysfunctional identity that's been created. Maybe an example is helpful. So you could say that somebody who... I met somebody who was abused, and they would... when they were quite young, and actually I didn't know them very long before we were having a conversation about that, and I saw this happen in lots of different social... it was their way of knowing who they were was sort of fixed at that point in their life when this thing happened. So using that... so I want to bring one more little piece of theory in, which is the idea, the very ancient idea, that the mind is a dot, or without any memory store. So let me, how do you illustrate this? So the idea in very early Buddhist psychology was not that you remembered something and sort of kept it in you, but it was that the memory of that thing existed somewhere in the sort of spiritual plane, if you like, or that something existed in the spiritual plane and your mind went to it. And even, in fact, when you had... So when you had a memory, it would be like that your mind sense was going to the place where that thing happened and then it was coming back again. When you had an idea, it was like that your mind was travelling to a particular place where that idea was and then came back. And the reason why I'm saying this is because in some ways that is a little bit like how memory works, although now we sort of think of memory as being inside you somewhere. There is a sense in which the reason that a particular memory is alive in you is because something in your personality keeps going to that memory. Something about, I am this sort of person, so I need to keep going back to this memory. There's something, and you can see it from two points of view. From the point of view of the memory, there's something, there might be something very powerful and unsolved about it. And from the point of view of the person, there's something very compelling about that memory that supports their identity. So in the case of the abused person, they get something, some secondary gain out of going to that memory. And that gain is actually just might simply be a sense of knowing who they are, because that's what they've lived with for so long. And also there's something very powerful about that memory, because there's some unresolved question there. You can see it from both points of view. So if you're in that situation, you can either go into therapy and try and resolve the question of that very powerful memory, and sometimes that's very appropriate. Or you can do a mindfulness practice where when you notice that you're starting to evoke that memory again, when you notice that you're starting to hook back into that story, you put your attention somewhere else, or you think, and in that way you sort of try and create a bit of distance and separation. And I suppose what the ideal is, so I'll leave it there for a moment. So just to sort of sum up a little bit, what we're saying is that when something happens, good or bad, the Buddhist idea is that we then create a story around all of the events in our life, and that becomes a fixed story about who I am. And actually every day we recreate that story by going back to those memories, by talking about those things. If my story is I'm somebody who likes going to the theatre, and then I keep going to the theatre, I'm reinforcing that story about myself. And that's fine, that's not a dysfunctional story. And the Buddhist idea is often talked about as selflessness. So in one way you could describe that as having no stories whatsoever. But I think a more useful way of saying it is that you have many different stories about your life. So you're not just somebody who goes to the theatre, you're somebody who enjoys this and enjoys that and doesn't enjoy that. And you've got a very sort of expansive sense of who you are, which probably includes all the different traumatic things that have happened to you, but doesn't exclusively include those things. So that when... If you have... So, okay, let's leave that there. So to go back to the Victorian lady who's in mourning, what she does is for that year she's created, or gentleman, I've imagined a lady for some reason, she creates an identity around being somebody in mourning that's supported by society. And also, as somebody whose partner has died, there's very real emotional feelings that fill that identity. So it's very congruent, it's entirely appropriate to have an identity around being in mourning when somebody has died, because, you know, it's sort of hardwired into us to grieve, and that's fine. Then at the end, and that's supported in that situation, her grieving is allowed by society. So it's a very sort of healthy situation. At the end of that period of mourning, society then supports a different story, which is that now it's time to move on. And then she begins to engage in the world in lots of different ways, which include, in the past I mourned for a year, but also now I'm meeting new people, I'm engaging in different social situations, I'm enjoying the garden again, all these different things come back in, and that's supported by society as well. So her new identity is also very functional and healthy, and I suppose the sort of, in that example, the dysfunctional identity, maybe not dysfunctional, but is when somebody is trapped in that mourning period beyond a year, say, in that example, so that 5 years later they're still struggling to form new relationships with people or struggling to enjoy the gardening, and that's the sort of time where you want to be asking, how can I recreate my story? How can I engage with the world in a different way? So this question, what's my story, is very powerful. And a Zen master, female Zen master, Zen mistress, I'm not sure, I think she was just, that sounds a bit weird, I think she was just known as a Zen master, once told me that her practice was actually just asking, what's my story, particularly in personal interactions. So she was talking about holding judgments in her mind about other people as much as her story about herself. And actually said, so for her, one of the most useful things that she does is ask herself, what's my story in this situation? Who am I going in as in this situation? So that's, that question is, if you take away anything from this morning, that question is probably one of the most important things. What's my story in this situation? And then following on from that, is it helpful to have a second story?
How can I stop it?
You can't stop it. You can't stop the phone ringing.
Yeah.
Turn it off at the wall, I suppose.
What if you've not got a story?
Then you're lying.
Really?
Oh, I think we...
Yeah, I think so. There's a couple more... Let me see whether I want to say anything else. Then we can... room. I want to go back for the... So, and I'll include what you said, and then we can have some more time for discussion at the end. I just want to see if there's any other sort of main things that I want to plug in that might answer that. Yeah, so Dawn said, what if you haven't got a story? Well, my sort of supposition would be that everybody, or the idea of Buddhist psychology is that everyone does have a story, but it may be more or less unconscious. And actually, if you really feel like you're in a situation you don't have a story, it may be that you're in a particularly open place and willing to receive what's really going on in the world, or it may be that you're in the grip of a story that you don't know anything.
You're not in control
about.
Of.
Yeah, that you're not.
Are we ever really in control?
Yeah, and I suppose there is a sense in which there's layers and layers and layers, and at some level there's a sort of greatest. There's always going to be a layer of mystery, and this is a sort of. And in fact, in some ways, an ideal position to be in is. It's sort of, most of the time we're not conscious of our stories, and actually when you think about how we learn, you begin by learning something consciously, like when you learn to drive, you think about, oh, I need to do this now, and then I need to turn this and flick that up and push this down and do all those at the same time, and oh, there's something coming. But once you've been doing it for a while, you don't think about any of that. You just have a conversation with the person who's sitting next to you. So the sort of normal learning cycle is that things begin consciously and then become unconscious. And I think the same thing happens with stories that we tell about ourselves.
Yeah, that's a good analogy.
Yeah, and most of the time that's fine, actually. And I'm not saying that people shouldn't have stories, but what I'm saying is so today's thing is difficult emotions. Difficult for me, those kind of emotions are a clue that I've got a story that's going on that's not functional in some way. So if I'm getting angry or if I'm really sad, I can say, okay, what's really going on here? Is what I'm feeling appropriate to what's just happened in the world? If it is, then maybe it's appropriate to feel angry when somebody just punched you in the face. But if someone said something and you're the only person, there were three of you there and you're the only one who got angry about what they said, there's probably something in some unconscious story in me that has been triggered, or that sort of hooks into what they've said, and I can maybe talk to them about what they've said, but also it's very there's some important work in asking, what's my story in that situation, and just allowing that to become more conscious again. And when it becomes more conscious, that's when you maybe have a chance to change it. So that's one way of doing it. The other way is that just when you notice it come, the feelings or the difficulty coming up, is that you put your attention somewhere else in that moment. So you do some breathing exercises, some people carry something in their pocket that they just touch, and it kind of takes them out of that story a little bit, and you carry on, and then later on you go and write in your journal, this is what happened, what story was that connecting with? So I think most of the time the stories that we tell are completely functional. You know, if somebody says to you, what's your name? What do you do? Those are the first two questions that anybody asks when they meet you. And so straight away there's some kind of narrative about your life in place. And that's completely normal and appropriate, as I say. So the other thing that I wanted to mention is this sort of ideal in Buddhism is to live what's called the noble life. The first teaching the Buddha did was called the Four Noble Truths, and essentially he said, what I'm doing is describing how somebody who lives the noble life lives. And Dharmavijja's interpretation is simply that, I say simply, simple to say, is that when you experience a difficult emotion, you then have a choice about what to do with it. You can either use that to face the situation that you're in, which might mean engaging with the world and saying to somebody, when you did that thing I thought was really inappropriate, or it might be asking yourself, what's really going on for me in this situation? Both of which are very challenging things to do for most people and require some confidence or faith that there's going to be, that it's a useful process to be engaged in. Or you can use that energy to get really angry or to get really greedy or to get really destructive. But the ideal is to be able to sit or stand or be in that situation, notice what's happening for you, and then do something constructive with it. And that's very challenging. And what I talked about last time was that actually, for me, what makes the difference between whether I do that or not is sort of almost a sense of knowing that it's a good thing to do. And partly that comes from having done it before and having seen other people do it. So I'm just looking at my notes. So I'll maybe just sum up what we talked about and then we can go into some discussion, because there's obviously people asking things. So we talked about how we create identities around things that have happened to us or around our responses to things that have happened to us. So either we tell a story about, I was somebody who did this, or when that thing happened, we did some action, went out and ate something or bought something, pushed everybody away and create a story around those things. And that sometimes these things are appropriate, like with the Victorian woman who's grieving, and that sometimes they're inappropriate and you sort of need a little bit of wisdom to discern which is which. And that part of what we do as human beings is continually... Come down then, the kitten's calling. is to recreate those stories, often just because we feel a sense of comfort in knowing who we are. One of the most difficult things is to change. You hear me talking from upstairs? And there's different ways of doing that. Okay, maybe I'll stop there. Namo Amida Buddha.
Namo Amida Buddha.